Thank you, Rob. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'll get right to it. I'm going to be speaking about just a portion of the Pacific Northwest, which we call the Inland Pacific Northwest Cropping Region, Dryland Cropping Region, as you can see. It's very diverse. It has three unique precipitation zones. Find the cursor, there it is. We have a low precipitation, and that's less than 300 millimeter annual, and that's over in this part, sort of on the western. We do have an irrigated zone over here, but I'm not going to be addressing that. That's water diverted from the Columbia River, which has been a very supports billions of dollars of agriculture every year. But anyway, that elusive cursor. If you move further to the east, and we have what we call an intermediate rainfall zone, that's 300 to 450 millimeters a year, and then what we call high rainfall zone, which is 450 to 600 millimeters a year. That's the Palouse region. Many of you may have heard of that region. And there's just a close-up of the whole thing right there. I would like to acknowledge three organizations, two funding sources. Number one, the Columbia Plateau PM10 Project, which for many years funded wind erosion research out in this region, which is, and it's a huge problem in the drylands. And also the SEEP program, the Solutions to Economic and Environmental Problems, which is more focused on the water erosion, which is the problem in the higher precip regions. These programs are no longer in place. They were considered earmarks, even though they received very high evaluations and were very productive. And so Congress has not funded those anymore. But we do have the Direct Seed Association, which was started by farmers back in 1998, and that's really pushing the direct seed movement, especially in the intermediate and high precip zones throughout the Pacific Northwest, and they're a very active group. So let's start with the low precipitation zone, and that's the zone that I predominantly work in. That's the less than 300 millimeter. The cropping system is pretty simple. It's two-year winter wheat, summer fallow. Scientists and researchers and farmers have for years looked for alternatives to this system. And we found, continuous annual cropping, alternative crop. We've tried a lot of things. But when it comes right down to it, nothing is as stable or as profitable as the winter wheat fallow system. And so more than 95% of the farms in this region still practice winter wheat summer fallow. Well, why is that? Why can't? And this leads to, it's a tillage-based system. And I'll talk about that a little bit, why there are good tillage. But of course, if you do too much tillage, you can get these sandy loam soils pulverized, and that can happen very readily and bury the residue. We have dust storms. This material also has quite large amounts of small particulates, PM10 that becomes airborne, and so that's an air quality concern. And so blowing dust is a big problem. And this isn't a recent problem. This goes all the way back. It's better now than it used to be. These lands have only been farmed for 135 years. They were native bunch grass and sagebrush before that. And so they broke it out and they tried some different things in the 1880s. And then by 10 years, they figured, well, winter wheat follows the thing that works. And so they stuck with that. And what were they using? They were using a moldboard plow and then a spike tube harrow to control weeds, and they would just completely pulverize the ground. I found this photo down in on campus in the library in a shoebox and in the archives, and this was at Adams County, Washington, 1931, and I believe it. I know exactly where this is. And here they had their ground completely pulverized. The only thing growing there is Russian thistle, which is our worst weed. That was bad, and we know it was bad, and we want to get away from that. It's not like that now, but it was then. So why don't we just go with no-till follow, like they do in the Great Plains very successfully? And this is my research station at Atlanta, the WSU Dry Land Research Station, and we've done lots of research on this. And boy, it's perfect for wind erosion control, but it's not very good for seed zone water content. And why is the reason? Because this is a Mediterranean climate. We get our rain and snow during the winter. The summers are warm and dry. And if we don't break soil capillary continuity to halt that upward movement of liquid water, we dry out the seed zone with the no-till follow. And when that happens, we can't plant wheat early. And we want to plant wheat early because if we don't, and when I mean early, that's planting it into carryover moisture that we can reach with a drill, then we have a very severe yield penalty, which averages 36% but can reach 50%. So you want to plant your wheat early. And just to show you, this is a... I really would like to find the cursor. Oh, there it is. Good. These are just two sites. These are 5 years of data, average data at two sites. We'll just call them western site and eastern site, both in that wheat follow zone. And we have three systems, a traditional tillage, undercut, and no-till. But let's pay attention to what happens. There it is. What we need to germinate and emerge a wheat seedling is about 11% moisture by volume, which is right there. That's negative 0.50 megapascal. We can go to 0.6 megapascals and cross our fingers and hope it works, and sometimes it does. But we really try to want to shoot for planting wheat into this this 11% water. Well, where do we have to go to get it? All right, let's go up here with our tilled foliage system. So we're going down to 20 centimeters there to get it. And we never do get it in no-till. And we find the same thing over here. So we can basically, with tillage systems, we can retain enough water most years to plant wheat into carryover water to get our best yields. With no-till, we have a drying of that seed zone, and we can't get it. So farmers aren't practicing no-till out in those right regions. Here's a site that we had in the western Horse Heavens, which is, happens to be a 150-millimeter annual precip zone in the actual epicenter of the driest wheat production region of the world. And their average yield, and this is an average yield. We had 1,200 kgs per hectare this year, which is 18 bushels an acre. And so that's a typical yield out in the western Horse Heavens in a wheat follow rotation. The farmer is quite happy with that, and he's profitable because he farms 17,000 acres, half of that in wheat, half of that in follow. And so it's just a matter of scale and keeping your variable costs down. Now, out in this region, we found that he can go to the no-till follow, which is just wonderful, because it's so dry out there that he doesn't have that water, that seed zone water, to plant anyway, hardly ever. And so they might as well go to the no-till follow and keep down the blowing dust, and they're going to get the same yields, and we got the same yields as whether we tilled it or did not till it. So that's good news for them, and they pretty readily accepted that. They said, yeah, we can do that, so they're going to do that. But in these other systems, here's what they're going at, and here's the system we're looking at. This is a wheat seedling. Here's the seed. And here it's coming up to the soil from deep planting. And you get up here to about 4.5 inches, 11 centimeters, and you see that? That's the tip of the coleoptile. That's the sheath that surrounds the first leaf. So, okay, it's punching through that coleoptile, and now we've got a true first leaf. Well, it's still underground, and I'm having trouble. There's the cursor. And here we finally get up to about, let's call it close to 7 inches, and it's finally coming out of the ground. That's the kind of wheat seedling that we need and do have to a certain degree in the Pacific Northwest. So, this thing is 10 inches long. It's extended 10 inches in 10 days. You know, so this is a very fast process, and it's a very critical process. And the farmers know all about this, and They're seeding deeper than anybody in the world. So it's another unique thing. So that's the dry part. Let's get up. I said up to 300 millimeters. You get up to 300 millimeters, that's pretty stable ground there. They're still practicing wheat fallow. You can go to a spring wheat. I have a long-term cropping system. Systems trial about about 10 kilometers from here, and spring crops can work on wetter years here, but it's still wheat fallow country, and they can produce some pretty darn nice yields, 55 bushels an acre, 3,700 kgs per hectare, and again they can do a good job and make some money on that. Can they do something else besides the traditional tillage? Oh yes, and this has been shown by long-term research, lots of research. And one of the best implements to use is what we call an undercutter conservation. This is not exactly a noble plow. That was talked about in some sessions yesterday. This is a much more sophisticated device than a noble. It's much narrower. These blades are 32 inches wide. We can control the depth on them. We also have this thing hooked up with the, see this manifold here? And this tank, that's for injecting liquid nitrogen, aqua, and some sulfur right down behind those blades. And so we're combining operations. And that's the kind of seed bed we'd like to have for fallow. If you don't have, on some of the cloddier, better aggregated soils, you don't want the big clods. We've learned that we can just build and attach this type of thing behind it, which is, we call this a skew treader. We can angle this if we want to be a little or more aggressive, but the main thing is to leave a seed bed with lots of residue on it. And this is a separate study, but that can just show you the difference from a long view, the difference between traditional tillage and undercutter tillage. So it makes a big difference. And the farmers were really reluctant at first. They said, well, yeah, that looks okay, but you're leaving too many clods underneath your tillage layer. And so we're going to lose all our water. And so a lot of us did research for a lot of years, and we've conclusively shown, without a doubt, that the water is the same. And so the farmers are believing that now. And so they say, okay, we want to practice this conservation tillage. We're believers, so we should be practicing that. And then after you do your primary tillage sometime in the spring, and if you have weeds, you go out with a rotary rod weeder, which happened to be invented in the Pacific Northwest in 1907. And it's still, every farm has one. Great way of controlling weeds, non-inversion. So we're all set. And so this is the way it should be looking out there in that wheat fallow system. That's the way it should look, but it's not. And that's because the drills that we have cannot pass through the residue that we are capable of achieving with conservation tillage. They plug up. And no farmer wants to plug his drills up when he's planting his crop, especially when this is really time critical. And so they have a tendency to keep tilling and tilling until they don't have much residue left, and then they have this drill, which has been around for over 50 years. It's a great drill, but it can't pass through residue. So we need to work on that, and we have. And we collectively have developed a couple prototypes that work really well. This one here. There it is. These are, we call a packer wheel. They're big and tall. We've got a lot of clearance for residue. And then the seed boot down here, we built this thing so it can go way down. We want them to be able to reach that seed zone of moisture no matter how far it's down and not have that being a limiting factor. But the key is this coulter in front. And we have that offset and to the side. We have two coulters. We have this 26-inch notch coulter, and then we have a bigger, even bigger smooth coulter. But the whole idea is to either cut or tuck the residue to the side of that opener and just sort of get it out of the way temporarily until this opener can pass and plant the wheat without plugging the drill. And it works really well. The trouble is, this is an 8-footer that we built. My technician actually built it. He's really a wizard at this. He built the whole thing in the ground up. It's got a lot of, it's got bearings and a rolling coulter, and it's going to cost money if you're going to make a 50-footer like that. So he built another one at the station here, and this is a much simpler type. We call this a shovel drill, and it's on two tiers. these openers, and you've got a front gang and a back gang, and again, these big packer wheels, and high clearance, that's the key. You leave lots of room for that residue to pass, and also easy to work on, too, lots of room. And we've gone out and purposely set up really high residue tilled plots with conservation tillage, and in this case, 6,700 kgs per hectare residue, and have successfully seeded through this without plugging. And so the farmers have all seen this. They've been out at the site. They've seen the presentations. They said, yeah, that works really great. Where we get one of these drills? And so actually, we're working on this, and the private sector and the political movement and the conservation effort, it's all sort of coming together. And the private sector actually hopes to have a 50-foot-wide one to test this next planting season. So this thing will go through the residue, and you go out there and you check it, and this is the next spring, and that's just fine. Matter of fact, of all the things we tested, that shovel drill has had the highest yield bar for 3 years in a row. So you can plant this way and get a great crop, and that's the way I think we really need to go if we're going to stay with this tillage system. And before I leave the wheat fallow, I just want to say another tool that's come along recently for water is this, we call it an holo-till. Case IH makes it, John Deere makes it. It's got this big, long shank with a narrow boot down here. And this is, the farmers were originally interested in this to break up what they call the hardpan layer. They thought the wheat wasn't growing well through that. But it also has the added benefit of opening up some slots for water to run in when if the water runs off during winter. And it works really well. Here you can see it in the field. They do it on dry soil right after harvest, and it will trap. It does a lot less disturbance than their traditional chisel, which we've been trying to get them away from because it does too much disturbance. So I bet half the farmers in that wheat fallow area have purchased one of these in the last 5 years or so. Let's move up to the intermediate zone, 970,000 cropland acres and hectares, and you can see there's a lot more options up there. And these rotations are practiced. One thing you'll notice, they're all winter wheat based, pretty much. Winter wheat, summer fallow, it's basically a three-year rotation. Winter crop, winter wheat, spring crop, summer fallow. The good news up there is it's all moving towards most of it's moving towards the no-till fallow. They don't have the seed zone water limitations, and so that it's really moving up to the no-till fallow in the intermediate precip zone. And there's some new crops coming in, winter canola being one, very successful, growing winter canola, summer fallow, winter wheat, summer fallow. Also some pulse crops coming in. And again, a lot of it just really going to direct seeding. So that's the way to go. And the winter canola up there is really quite remarkable. These beat some of the irrigated winter canola yields in the basin. This is a 425 millimeter precip zone with 3,900 kg per hectare winter canola. So everybody is really watching this crop, and several of us are working with canola. Moving up to the Palouse, 820,000 cropland acres, very diverse, very hilly. Most productive dryland wheat production region in the world. And they can do there's no fallow there. Just, well, you might see some here and there, but essentially no fallow. Lots of rotations. One that's real popular right now is winter wheat chickpea. And John Krugergaard, who's here, was talking about yesterday, you don't want to go to a two-year rotation, and I agree with him completely if you can expand that. Well, why are they doing winter wheat chickpea in the Palouse right now? Because you can make big money on both right now, is what they're doing. And so they're going to do that, a lot of them, until they can't do it anymore, and then they're going to expand their rotation. You even have people, when the wheat price is high, going to continuous winter wheat. And you don't do that very long without getting a lot of grassy wheat problems. But mostly you see a three-year rotation. Winter wheat, spring cereal, grain legume, winter wheat, spring barley. Also the pulse crops are coming in, including some camelina. And steep hills and big wheat yields. Those are low average wheat yields of 7,000 kgs per hectare. That's about 105 bushels an acre. But it's not uncommon to go to 9,000 kgs per, 140 bushels per acre, big slide slopes. These hillside combines don't tilt as much as they used to. They only go to 35 degrees now, and they don't need to because they now have the rotary separator system. So they used to tilt up to 50 degrees, and that makes for some pretty wild shots. And then the farmers are generally not farming these real steep slopes. But in the past, and even today, a lot of the ground in that high region is still moldboard plowed. Here, back in the 1950s, they had these little tractors, and they didn't have the power to do much, and so they pushed, and this is a big deal. They used a moldboard plow, and they pushed the furrow, they pushed the soil downhill. See how this is pushing the soil downhill? Well, you might think that that's not too big a deal, but when you do that year after year, decade after decade, it moves a lot of soil out there, and you're denuding your tops of your hills down to nothing. And so now they have the big tractors, of course, and the bigger plows, and if they're mobile and plowing, and it still goes on, but they're pushing the soil, they're doing it the other way, they're pushing the furrow uphill. So that helps. And this way also left it very smooth, and which was a hazard for water erosion. Now they're pushing it uphill, which leaves it rougher, which is much less of a water erosion hazard. But here's just an example of some of the severe, rill and gully erosion and sedimentation that has occurred and can still occur. It has not been as bad as in recent decades, but it used to be just pure, really awful. And here's one where we just had a mass failure. Just got so Chinook wind, melting snow, saturated, frozen soils beneath, nowhere to go, and this happened. This was actually, if you look closely, was planted into winter wheat after a legume crop, most likely fallow back then. But, what is that slope? That's definitely more than 50%. Those are all in CRP now. I mean, nobody's farming those types of slopes. But they did, and this type of thing happened, and it happened for many decades. So now, and I'm about done here, Rob, that is changing, fortunately. And so, I mentioned the Direct Seed Association. They're very active, and they're very active in this high precip zone, especially where it's most important, really, for water erosion. And so they can farm these slopes with direct seeding. And it's a little bit touchy because the slopes are steep, but you have a short linkage between your tractor and your equipment. You don't want that hanging out forever or else it'll start sliding down the slope. So you put a short linkage. This individual that actually has a self-leveling tractor, if you'll notice. And he said, well, if I'm going to ride these slopes all day, I don't want to be sitting on an angle. I'm just going to have a self-leveling tractor. So they can do this, and they're moving that way. I tried to get some statistics for this talk, and we're a little light on that. A lot of roadside surveys. But it's estimated that about 50% of the farmers in the Palouse are using some sort of direct seeding. And that might be for their winter crop after spring cereal when the residue's not so heavy. And it's also estimated that about 15% are true direct seeders that won't do anything but direct seed. And that is changing, too. It's increasing every year, and it's increasing as the younger farmers come in. And so the prognosis is good for the future, I think, with the new technology and the new generation coming in. And just the economics of no-till, if you look at it, they make a lot of sense versus the tillage-based systems. So that's what I have, and I thank you, Robert. John's question is, what about these wheats in the Long Cali Alto? All of our wheats in the Pacific Northwest are semi-dwarfs, except for a couple hard red types. We have no soft white types. All of our soft white types have these short Cali Altos. That was just sort of a green revolution thing that happened, the RHT1, RHT2. We're trying to move away from that to get some long Cali Alto wheats because that's a big driver on emergence, as you know. Our current wheat breeder is open to that. I've been working, I'm trying to help them with that type of work. But the short answer is we need at least some lines for these real dry areas that have a longer coleoptile and or the ability to emerge from deeper depths. And that is now being realized. The farmers are already realized now it's getting more attention.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.